Well, last week's sermon was course correction, C-O-U-R-S-E, talking about how we always have the ability to correct our course, to look at where we're going, and to take different aim that's better and truer to our deepest, most examined values. Today is course correction, C-O-A-R-S-E, and it is about the various manifestations of coarseness in our lives, of how our world, our society, our human interaction has become coarser and coarser over time, and that this coarseness of language leads to coarseness of behavior. It can create a sclerosis in our hearts so that our hearts close down. Words do make a difference. How we think about people, how we talk to people, the tone that we take makes a difference in how we feel, in the hormones and the adrenaline and the norepinephrine that goes through us, and it results in actions. They are not separate. When I look at the coarseness of our society, there are times when I just want to weep. The names that we call each other, the incivility of our dialogue. We don't have adversaries, we have enemies. We look at people who may vote differently from us, or dress differently, or worship differently, and say, you're not simply wrong, you're evil. And I'm not talking about everybody in this congregation, about everybody in any community. But that's the tone and the tenor of society, that we have made enemies out of adversaries, and adversaries when we could find sometimes common cause. It becomes harder and harder to form important coalitions with people whom you don't simply disagree with on an important issue, but you despise because of that disagreement. I tell the story often, and forgive me if you've heard it, but I'm going to keep telling it till we get it right, about my closest friend when I was in divinity school in Northern California, who was studying to be a Roman Catholic priest. We did not agree on theology. We did not agree on Christology. We did not agree on some of the great social issues, but we were very good friends, cooperated in one of the doctoral classes in a mutual presentation. And we used to ride together to demonstrations, sometimes anti-war demonstrations, where we marched on the same side. And sometimes it would be a pro-choice demonstration where we marched on different sides. But we always came back together and had lunch together, and he was my friend. The fact that we disagreed over something that is important didn't make him evil. It just made him wrong. But it didn't make him evil. And that's okay. It's okay to be, if it's not okay to be wrong, don't ever try to be in a relationship with anyone. It's okay to be wrong, but it doesn't mean that you have to demonize the opposition. And our rhetoric has gotten to that point. And it's shocking. Now, I know that every age has this kind of astigmatism of nostalgia, where we look back at the past as some golden age when we were all very nice to each other and there was complete civility, when the skies were blue and the humor wasn't. And it's mostly not true. We were somewhat incivil at various times in our history. People got into loud arguments, but not to the depth and not with the noise and not with the shamelessness that we use today. And, you know, when people say, but these are really important issues, I need to call this person an enemy because they're an enemy of all that is good and decent and true. That's usually not how you change minds and get allies. You know, if demonizing the opposition worked, I might be for it. But I want to be pragmatic about this. It doesn't work. All you do is take an adversary and make them an enemy and foreclose the opportunity of cooperating where you could cooperate. The incivility is, well, an example. About 2 months ago, Jennifer gave me a lead on a story about a young man with autism who was being turned down for a heart transplant because he had autism. And I wrote something about that, and it took off kind of virally across the country, which made me feel really good until I read the couple of hundred comments. And most of the comments were positive and were supportive, but there were some that were so mean-spirited. Oh, he ought to die. Oh, he's just a moron. Why waste a good heart on a worthless piece of junk? And the song keeps going through my head. How can people be so heartless? How can people be so cruel? Easy to be cold. Easy to say no. I look at strings of comments on various internet sites where I'm published, and it's not that I can't take the heat. It's like, where's the social contract? Where's the golden rule? How is it that people who are so easy with dismissing and demeaning and demonizing people who disagree with them or with whom they disagree, do they want to be treated like that? Where is that social contract of the golden rule? Well, I was thinking about all of this as I was reading the obituaries about 2 weeks ago. It's an occupational hazard, not just a question of age. And I saw the name of a teacher of mine from junior high school, Mr. Ware. I didn't even know his first name. He was Mr. Ware. He taught math that I was appallingly bad at. I'm close to being innumerate, which is math for illiterate. He also was a sports coach. I did very badly in math. I did not earn my letter in sports. I never really succeeded in his class, and I adored him. He had a certain old school, even for the 50s, dignity. Mr. Ware, I only learned that his name was Harold Bud Ware in reading the obituary. Mr. Ware called each of the students by our last names, Mr. or Miss. He was a throwback with a formality and a sense of respect. And the example that respect is a two-way street. He expected to be respected as a teacher, and he gave respect back to his students. When I went on the memorial page, there were hundreds of students, former students, who had written tribute to this man, and many of the comments were about his dignity, his formality that didn't get in the way of being accessible. It's not a bad example. It's not a bad example in a world where we confuse intimacy with familiarity, where you are called by your first name by strangers who are looking at your credit card when you've swiped it at the grocery store, if not being called honey or sweetie or darling, where there's only this false form of intimacy without connection and not a sense of, I'm going to deal with you as an individual. It's not the most horrible social problem, but I think that it leads to the coarsening and the sclerosis in our hearts. That when we can yell at people, when we can scream at people, when we can write invective that is homophobic and anti-Semitic or anti-Muslim or anti-whatever group you're attacking, and that seems okay to people, is an issue of both form and content. Another issue of content happened when my wife came back from temple services on Yom Kippur, and she said that her rabbi told a story about Mount Everest. And I knew the story. And I didn't sit, so I'm not stealing the sermon. I don't know what he said. But believe me, when you hear the story, you understand that the three paragraphs write themselves. The story, and I had read about it in May when it happened, was that a young, very young Israeli climber on Mount Everest, Nadav Ben Yehuda, was within striking distance of the summit, a couple of hundred feet. And he encountered somebody laying in the snow without oxygen and without gloves on. That person was going to die and die quickly. Others had stepped over him on their way to the summit. Others had stepped over him descending from the summit because the social contract, the norm, conformity says, thank you, Ed, conformity says the contract is when you're a climber, you're on your own. If you snooze in the snow, you lose your life. There is no affirmative duty to help somebody. Maybe if you're a guide and you've already had your summits, maybe there's an option to help rescue somebody. But if you're just a regular climber, you paid a lot for that summit, and you're not going to give it up for someone else, and you're not expected to. He stopped because he saw the young Turkish man, Aydin Irmak, and he picked him up, put on his own gloves, shared oxygen, and began carrying him down the mountain, giving up his own summit. Eventually, some other people joined in and helped him, eventually, and they got him back to a lower camp where they were both evacuated with frostbite because Ben Yehuda had given up his gloves. Well, this was a pretty big story, and of course, the media being the media, it was a story about how an Israeli had saved a Turk. It was a story about how a Jew had saved a Muslim. All fine, all exemplary, use it, write the story, terrific. In a decent world, this is not a story. Doing the right thing is not a story. The story, in my view, is all of the people who stepped over Irmak on the way to the summit, and all of the people who closed their eyes to a human being in distress and stepped over his body on the way down. We can spin this as a story of heroism, and it fits, but it's an appalling story of the conformity in a subculture that says it is expected of you to avert your eyes, to avert your hearts, to find an achievement, a sports achievement, more important than a human life. I want to sigh and weep as much as with all of those comment strings that demean and dehumanize other human beings. It just feels so wrong. And the nonconformity of Nadav Ben Yehuda, of not following the expected rules, I think that's a good story. And then as I was feeling terribly self-righteous as I was writing this, knowing that I would certainly have stopped, knowing that I wouldn't be on Everest, I thought about how you step over a body at 28,000 feet and not see it, and how we step over bodies on our own streets and not see them, and not see in the hungry and the homeless and the mentally disordered on our own streets that there are human beings there. That we sometimes, I won't put it on you, I sometimes will literally step over a body. I will sometimes literally walk to the other side of the street if I don't want to be hassled. I will literally avert my eyes and my heart follows. And it is an act of will, whether 28,000 feet or on the street, not to avert our eyes. It is an act of will not to step over the bodies. It is an act of will to try to make our belief, our faith, our commitment, our covenant to trying to see the inherent worth and dignity of all human beings, to turn back our gaze on these people, to turn back our hearts, to understand that they are a part of us and we are a part of them. That is the interdependent web. It is part of our responsibility not to conform to the norm and to the instinct, but to reach out and to see, to touch, to bond with people who don't think like we do, who don't worship like we do, who may not groom like we do or smell like we do. But both the form of how we talk to others and the content of how we treat others are deeply related. And we have the power, if not by instinct, by choice and by values, to be connected, to stay connected, to not step over the bodies, to not demean the other into adversary or into evil or into enemy, but to find in each person as we can something to connect to, something that we share in common in this life, some way that we can touch and help and assist and be of good moral and practical use to people. And it begins, I believe, with a really simple word, respect. Respecting the dignity in other human beings. Respecting how precious life is. And respecting the remarkable power we have to make a difference. The world may coarsen, but we can choose to smooth things out by our own choices. We can choose to be part of a non-conforming segment of society that tries to model a lessening of the coarseness of our society, that tries to act with our own dignity and with respect to this interdependent web and to the inherent dignity of all human beings.